Welcome to Greta Talk, and this is different from On the Record, which you watch on the Fox News Channel Monday through Friday at 7 p.m. This is Greta Talk, and today we have a world-famous author. You also know him another way. He had another career before that. He was the world's greatest chess player. But Garry Kasparov is my guest today, and he wrote a brand new book, Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. Garry, nice to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
I told you off camera before last week when we spoke, I loved your book. I think it's a book that finally put a lot of things in one place that I think a lot of people are interested in learning about.
That's what I did when I was a chess player. So I always wanted to operate with the big picture. And the book is an attempt to actually put together sort of different elements of this big picture, both, you know, in space and also in time. It's an analysis of the last 25 years, and I try to explain, you know, what did go wrong after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, and why today we're facing so many threats, and what is to be done, and why it matters.
Yeah, it really is so relevant to today. I mean, it talks a lot about things going on right now.
Absolutely, because people don't understand the nature of the threats. They don't see the connection between the lack of strategy in the U.S. foreign policy over last 20 plus years with three administrations, Clinton, Bush 43, and Obama. European sort of joyful mood of let's relax, let's, you know, get some fun and forget about problems because evil has disappeared. But evil doesn't disappear. We also yet to understand that globalization has a negative side as well. When we have all these tools that we enjoy so much using in trade, in business, in finances, in social cultural exchange, we forget that these tools are agnostic. They're neither good nor bad. And while we use them for positive agenda, there are other guys that use them for negative agenda. And unfortunately, they're even more successful because they defy the rules, they don't obey these rules, and they know how to use tools and devices invented by the free world against our core interests.
Is Putin evil?
Absolutely. He's the most dangerous dictator these days because he controls nuclear arsenal of Russia, and also he's quite desperate. He's willing to do whatever to stay in power, and every day that we're delaying strong response to him makes him more arrogant and more aggressive.
What's his goal?
Staying in power. That's all he cares for, and it's very tactical. Vladimir Putin, and I have to say to those who are using these chess metaphors, Putin playing chess, Putin's strategy, he does not play chess, he always plays poker, and he doesn't have a strategy. It's only about tactics. It's only about survival. A successful dictator, if you may call it successful dictator, cannot afford long-term strategy because every day he should watch not only his enemies but also his buddies, his henchmen behind him, because the moment he shows weakness, he's out of business.
I guess from an American perspective, if he stays in power and just stays in Russia, that's terrible for the Russian people, but not such a problem, you know, for the American people. But his danger, it extends beyond that? How does it affect Americans?
That's what I see. I've been saying it for a long time, and I demonstrated in the book that, you know, at one point he was Russian problem. Then he became the problem for former Soviet Union, for neighboring countries. But now he's problem for everybody because he reached a point where he ran out of enemies inside Russia and he needed enemies elsewhere. That's how dictator justifies him staying in power for indefinite period of time. Because economy no longer offers him any excuse. These conditions, economic conditions, will not get better. And Putin needed a new mythology. And confrontation with the free world, it's his main argument. It's a core of the new Russian propaganda campaign. And he will never stop. He will not cease creating conflicts, because he also he recognized that the United States and the free world was quite weak and timid today to offer adequate response.
In your book, you write, and it isn't something sort of a recent vintage that that there's a reaction to Putin as there is now, but you say, for years, as the human rights situation in Russia steadily deteriorated, Western politicians and experts such as Condoleezza Rice and Henry Kissinger defended Western feebleness in confronting Putin by saying Russians were better off than in the days of the Soviet Union.
It's a very tricky assessment because in the Soviet Union had a long history, and if you are talking about Soviet Union under Stalin, that would be probably the wrong comparison. Naturally, you know, you could say that life under Putin was better than the 70s or 80s, but why to compare Putin's Russia to the Soviet Union, not to Russia in the 90s? Yes, 90s were quite tumultuous period in Russian history, but it was a feeble foundation for democracy.
How did it happen, though, that the Soviet Union fell and there was sort of great hope that suddenly things were going to change? And you even sort of touch on it in your book, is that, you know, I think there was sort of dancing almost among Western nations that suddenly it was going to change. But in your book, as I understand your thesis, is that it didn't get, I mean, it's going backwards.
Oh, absolutely. And it's probably, you know, many Soviet citizens, you know, at the time of the collapse of communism, they just, you know, they had the wrong idea about democracy. So they believed that, you know, the ballot box is some form of ATM. So but the moment they vote, you know, they'll get benefits. So democracy in the minds of Russians was always connected, directly connected to the higher living standards. And the fact is that under Yeltsin, you know, the Russian people voted many times. We had more or less free and fair elections, but living standards not improved, or for many of Russians actually deteriorated. That, you know, sent the wrong message. And suddenly, with Putin in power, the oil prices jumped, and people could see, you know, a return on their votes. And Putin was very savvy in actually exploiting these beliefs, and the very fact that the leaders of the free world embrace him as one of the equals helped Putin's propaganda machine to deflect any criticism from our side, from the opposition side, while we try to reveal the dictatorial nature of his rule.
How do you think Putin looks at the United States and even of the Obama administration? What's his opinion?
Look, America is the number one target for Russian propaganda, and it's getting worse every day. But at the same time, I'm sure there's a huge respect because America is so powerful. But as for Obama administration and for the State Department, especially for John Kerry, I think there's no respect at all. It's just the Putin and his cronies. They could see this administration as a very convenient target for their psychological abuse.
What about the reset when our Secretary of State was Hillary Clinton? She went to had this reset with the foreign minister. Button had the wrong word printed on it, I understand.
It was one of the most disastrous moments in U.S. foreign policy.
Why?
Because it happened immediately after Putin's Russia invaded tiny Republic of Georgia, and instead of punishing him, or at least, you know, just creating some kind of understanding that, you know, it was unacceptable, he was rewarded with the sunshine policy of reset. You know, let's get together. And for 3.5 years, Obama's administration, the first Obama administration, tried to play Medvedev against Putin, which was, you know, a stupid mistake, since Medvedev was nothing but Putin's creation. And we have to give Putin a credit. He had a very successful KGB operation by having his stooge sitting in the president's chair and deflecting, you know, U.S. Not deflecting, actually eliminating the U.S. criticism and buying time to solidify his grip on power in Russia.
Is the sense, when I read your book, and I may be, you know, making this way too simple, but I get the sense that you see the American foreign policy as let's just get along instead of facing the corruption and the evil.
Absolutely. And it started, you know, with even Bush 41. Probably it's a natural reaction to the big victory in the Cold War. But if from World War II to the end of the Cold War, you could see the consistent U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, there were disagreements, but within a range between Democrats and Republicans. From 1991 to these days, we could see, you know, pendulum swinging from one side to another with no comprehensive strategy, which could help American allies to understand that, you know, the lasting institutions will always back certain policy and values, and America will not show her back to them, as Obama administration did many times.
What is Putin's plan, do you think, in Syria?
Again, he wants to create chaos. You know, definitely he hopes that the war in the Middle East will push oil prices up. But it's not only about oil prices. It's also about demonstrating his influence in the world on the world stage, and presenting himself as an indispensable leader who cannot be avoided in solving global problems. I think he hopes that one day, you know, the free world, led by the United States, will be ready to negotiate Syria for Ukraine, this kind of swap. But there's also one important factor: refugees. It's an often overlooked element of Putin's policy. He wants to push more refugees from Middle East to Europe, because arrival of hundreds of thousands, eventually millions of refugees to Europe, created great tension and helps directly Putin's allies in Europe, ultra-nationalist groups. They're gaining more power. And eventually, in Europe, everything decided by consensus. They will have their voice in deciding on Russian sanctions. And Putin believes that this gambit will pay off.
If oil prices went way down, if we somehow flooded the world with oil, so the prices went down, the supply grew enormously, what would that do to Putin?
He'll get desperate, and then most likely he will cross NATO borders. I think it's if a Russian economy is bankrupt and Putin understands that he has nothing else left, you know, to play with, he will become, you know, aggressive beyond his current level. And Estonia and Latvia are probably the targets. And we'd better prepare for this moment, understanding that Vladimir Putin is not going to walk away peacefully through the election process. The end of Putin's rule will lead to a chaotic period in Russia. It will be very a turbulent transition. And sooner it happens, better the chances for Russia to stay on the side of the civilized world and not to be torn in pieces as the Soviet Union.
Is most of Western Europe, and even the United States, does it appear to you mostly interested in sort of trying to contain Putin rather than any sort of sense of foreign policy, with a sense of morality and trying to fix what's going on there? Because living under communism is just the worst. And I don't think, you know, 100% of Americans don't know what it means to live in communism.
Oh, absolutely. They just believe that all their rights, you know, they just, you know, they inherit them from birth, you know, and they don't understand that there are still billions of people living under communism or other forms of totalitarian governments. But this is an illusion that, you know, you could contain evil in Russia or even in Iran. The most globalized economy in the world that depends on global trade, finances, you know, this cooperation, can't afford ignoring global security. And as long as Putin is there, you know, there will be he will be a problem. And this problem has been growing, and it will be growing. And we know from history that every delay in responding to this challenge will simply push the price up.
The plane that the Russian jet that went down, what do you anticipate will be Putin's response to that, if it turns out that it's ISIS and a bomb?
The Russian press, Kremlin control press, has been vehemently denying.
Why?
Because then many Russians could ask a simple question. I mean, what the hell are we doing in Syria? I mean, it's Chechnya terrorism. It was also bad, but at least Chechnya is part of Russia. Now, sending Russian troops in Syria, endangering lives of thousands of Russians, and eventually, you know, just losing 224 Russian lives, that could create, you know, great tension in even in today's Russian society.
So it doesn't sort of empower everyone, like sort of joined in grief, let's go get them, that kind of thing. It actually is.
Syria is too far away. It's the Russian propaganda hasn't yet worked out, you know, the rationale for Russian intervention thousands and thousands of miles away from Moscow. And it seems to me that Putin's propaganda machine, you know, has been now trying to come up with his rationale. But we saw this latest news that Russia halts all the flights to Egypt, basically recognizing that it was a terrorist attack, because if it was simply, you know, a technical or mechanical failure, then you don't have to hold all the flights.
So what's next for Putin on this?
I don't know, but it's his, just yesterday he was aggressively promoting the idea of defending the rights of Russian citizens in Syria, Yemen, and Libya. I'm yet struggling to explain what he meant, but following the recent pattern, I would expect him, you know, pushing even further, because he, as every dictator, he needs chaos, and he feels much more comfortable in chaos because he can thrive by making immediate decisions, and he also knows that there are 12 months left of this administration, and he will be, if he survives for 12 months, he will be dealing with someone else who will be far more decisive in responding to Putin's aggression.
Who do you think Putin's biggest nightmare for president is?
I don't think Putin can afford thinking, you know, the 12 months or 13 months ahead right now. But I think he understands that whoever it is, Hillary Clinton or a GOP, it will be a different administration that will be not doing the same things as Obama's administration. And Putin will have to prepare for a different level of confrontation. I think that they are more afraid of a GOP candidate, because it could be a more dramatic shift from current policies, since Hillary Clinton was somehow compromised in this reset policy, and they dealt with her. The Republicans, they could come up with a brand new sort of layer of foreign policy executives, and that could be something that dictators, they're always aware of new faces and new ideas and new arrangements, because they used to strive with old patterns.
Why does he want Ukraine so much? What's the big deal?
Ukraine is an existential threat to Putin's rule in Russia. It's a country that's so close to Russia, mentally, historically, ethnically. And it's just pro-European Ukraine. Ukraine that is not run by a Putin's puppet. It's a message to people in Russia. So our Ukrainian cousins, brothers and sisters, you know, did it. Why not us? And Putin immediately recognizes the danger. So destroying Ukrainian statehood, it's paramount for his survival. That's why I believe he'll come back. Right now, his activities in Syria, it's still, you know, connected to Ukraine, because he needs the Western world to recognize his rights to call the shots in Ukraine, to control the post-Soviet political space, and Ukraine is his number one target.
Have you ever met him?
Nope.
I know he must hate you. He must hate you because you're behind the democracy movement, but he must not be a fan of yours.
Yeah, I never met Putin, but I don't think this meeting, if it could have taken place before, would have changed my opinion. He is a dictator. This is the man who has been steadily destroying my country. And as long as he stays in power, less chances Russia as a modern state will have in the future.
Do you play chess anymore?
Not professionally, but I'm...
I mean, like, even if... when was the last time you played a chess game?
Depends what you mean playing, you know.
Well,
official,
you put the things on the board.
No, I mean, the board is this. No, yes, I played an exhibition match with my... old friend and opponent Nigel Short 6 months ago in St. Louis, Missouri. So, and it was an exhibition match of the match of the legends. But
so you don't invite someone over on Saturday night and say, "Let's play chess." The two of you pull out the chessboard.
No, I could play on internet with some other grandmasters, but it's still my passion, and I do a lot in promoting chess for education. I believe the game deserves a more promotion and more publicity, but it's less than 30% of my time these days.
How old were you when you first started playing?
Six.
And do you like, I mean, how many moves ahead do you think, or doesn't it work that way?
No, it doesn't work this way because, you know, it depends, you know, on the character of the position. If position is very sharp, very complicated, every move can change it. So then, you know, you have to be very precise and you have to calculate. And I could do, you know, 4, 5, 6 moves at once, you know, my longest combination was 15 moves. But if you, you know, if you have, you know, very quiet position and you have to think about just a long-term strategy, so then the calculation is no longer paramount. So it's important to understand, you know, what is the demand of the position. So whether you have to sort of employ your tactical skills or you should stay with, you know, with long-term strategy.
Do you, was chess for you a job or was it really fun or was it sort of an addiction? What is chess for you? Or just sort of a natural, like breathing? I mean,
you know,
what is it?
You had these three definitions and each of them, you know, it could work out. So because the moment I discovered the game of chess at age 5 and a half, 6, so I was immediately addicted to the game. So I loved the game. I was intrigued by the sort of mysterious connections between these wooden pieces and a small board. And I never lost this passion. So for me, even today, chess is a great mystery, and I enjoy seeing a nice combination, you know, a nice plan, you know, it's a great game, great battle. It's a whole world, and I'm still attracted to it.
Okay, let me ask you sort of odd questions. All right, do you care whether you get the light-colored pieces or the dark-colored pieces?
It's a first move advantage. It's like serving tennis.
No, but you don't mind, like when I take out chess.
No, but it's a first move. It's just, you know, basically it's about making the first move. So you start, you know, you have certain advantage. It's this, statistically, I think the white wins about 53% of the games.
50? How much?
53.
Okay.
It's not like in tennis. You know, naturally, its advantage is much smaller. But actually, for the weaker players, you know, so this is the advantage of white pieces even greater.
All right. Well, I need every edge I can. Believe me, I need every little bit. Hope I can when I play. So it's like, I do need that. You play any other board games or sports?
No, I know how to play many other games.
How about cards? Any cards?
I play different cards, but again, I'm trying to refrain from, you know, just being engaged in any form of gamble, because I always say that, you know, I won so many world championship matches that I run out of my luck.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's called Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must be Stopped by Garry Kasparov. And you know what? What is actually so fascinating, but I hadn't thought about it this way, but it really, you do sort of step back and look at the world. You sort of step back and look at Putin in much way that someone, I would assume, looks at a chessboard, you know, all the pieces.
Yes, it's. I try to use my chess skills, my ability to analyze the situation, because, you know, I always try to see the connection between sort of different sides of the board, and I was probably the best, you know, to operate with you know, material quality time factor. So to understand how you can transpose one advantage into another. And this book is an attempt to actually, you know, employ all of these chess skills and qualities into presenting the 25 years of the modern history from my also personal perspectives, because I was a witness, but also in many cases an active participant in these events.
Well, I loved reading it. I've already given it to somebody else to read, saying that this is, you got to read this book, because it actually, for me, it really helped me understand a lot of what's going on now. And so I really appreciate it. It even touched history. Anyway, we've been talking to Garry Kasparov, and Garry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And remember, we're always adding to the Greta Talk collection. You can get the latest ones or catch up on the Greta Talk sessions you've missed at gretawire.com/podcast and gretatalk.com. We're also available on iTunes, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And of course, watch On the Record on the Fox News Channel at 7 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday.